May it please the court. My name is Molly Carlin. I'm an assistant federal public defender in the District of Arizona, and I represent Zane Dickinson. Now, Mr. Dickinson was convicted of attempted murder with no finding by the jury that he intended to kill anyone. Instead, the jury, he had committed attempted murder if he intended only serious bodily injury to the victim. And the state court held that this jury instruction was error, and the state now doesn't dispute that trial counsel was deficient for failing to object to the erroneous instruction.
So what do we do with the fact that his defense at trial was mistaken identity? It wasn't me.
Your Honor, I don't think that's relevant here. And I would note that that's something that the Arizona Court of Appeals considered. But it's not an appropriate consideration here because trial counsel was laboring under the misimpression that intent to cause serious physical injury was enough. So he had no need to argue that there was no intent to kill. And he certainly could have made that argument.
I thought, though, that the prosecution theory all along was that he was trying to kill him. And that's what they argued to the jury. And that seemed to me to be the thrust of the state appellate court's review of the record.
Well, 2 points on that, Your Honor. First, this court has said that in the Strickland analysis, the party's arguments have no relevance. Second, the state
court... Well, I'm not sure that's right, counsel. Have no relevance? I mean, we're reviewing under AEDPA, are we not, the reasonableness of the factual determination by the state court?
If Your Honor is talking about 2254E, the Arizona Court of Appeals decision is not entitled to 2254E deference because it didn't resolve any disputed questions of fact. The things the state is pointing to are really characterizations of the evidence. But beyond that, the Arizona Court of Appeals notes on the first page of its opinions on footnote 1 of ER 40 that it's reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to sustaining the conviction. That's really more of a sufficiency question. It's Dixon and Riley have both said in this court that that's not the test. And so it's unsurprising.
I'm having a hard time squaring your argument with the fact that there really isn't any challenge to the underlying facts here. The question is whether the thrust of the error was prejudicial to your client. And the state court resolved that by saying, even if the instruction was erroneous, the evidence was strong enough here on which a reasonable jury could easily conclude that he intended to kill.
Well, Your Honor, that decision or that analysis is not entitled to deference for 2 reasons. First, it was assessing a question of state law. The prejudice fundamental error standard is not the standard here.
But it doesn't it go to whether or not there is cognizable harm under Martinez versus Ryan? In assessing the ineffectiveness of appellate counsel?
It does not, Your Honor. The appellate court explicitly says that it is the 3 factors relevant to its prejudice determination are counsel's arguments, which the Supreme Court has said is not relevant, the defense theory, which, as I noted, was informed by IAC, which was not at issue in that decision, but also that it looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. So its analysis is really more of, was the evidence sufficient to sustain a conviction of intent to kill? Whereas the question here is not that, because we're not disputing that. The question is whether the jury alternatively could have found to a reasonable probability, just one juror to a reasonable probability.
But we're never going to be able to know that with a general verdict, are we? I mean, the problem is we have to be convinced that that this error was so prejudicial that we question the efficacy of the fairness of the trial, and we need to avert a mistrial of mischaracterization or mishap of justice as a result.
Well, Your Honor, you can, and it's really a totality of the circumstances review of the evidence. I would note that the standard is high, extremely high, particularly in Gray. The evidence was that the defendant said he was going to blow the victim's brains out and then tried to shoot him a number of times. Here, the evidence is less egregious than that. The evidence
is maybe less egregious, but it's pretty persistent. I mean, first you have the threats, then you have the, you know, I'm going to take an axe to you, and then he says I'm going to kill you, and then he gets in his car or his truck and he runs him over twice, and then comes back and says to the witness, "I did it." That's pretty strong evidence that he was trying to kill him, isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't think so. And that's for two reasons. One, the altercations beforehand. Mr. Dickinson had an opportunity to kill Mr. Hatch if he wanted to, and he didn't. And the Gray Court said that showed that in that case, the defendant's intent was not necessarily to kill the victim. He also told Mr. Altizer, the homeowner, "I'm going to run him down." He didn't say, "I'm going to kill him." And the actual evidence, the testimony from Mr. Hatch of the incident was that the passenger side of the truck hit his bike. Then he fell off the bike, and it looks like then he rolled under the vehicle. So it's
after lying in wait in the field for him to come along on the bicycle.
That certainly would be evidence of intent that he, either intended to scare him or intended to hurt him. But the manner in which the truck hit the bike, it's not clear that it was, you know, inevitable or certainly that there was intent to kill him. And to the extent the evidence is ambiguous or equivocal, it was the state's burden to prove intent to kill beyond a reasonable doubt, or, you know, their erroneous theory of serious physical injury.
All the state courts that have looked at this have all concluded that the evidence was sufficient and that it did show that he intended to kill.
Well, Your Honor, I agree, but that's not the question. The question is not whether the evidence was sufficient to find intent to kill, but whether it was also susceptible to the inference that his intent was to commit serious physical injury. And I'll note that the trial judge thought that the state's case was not compelling. He said he wouldn't be shocked if there was no conviction on the attempted murder charge. And the trial judge was also laboring under the misimpression that intent to commit serious physical injury was enough. So the trial judge was skeptical that the jury would find even that. And the trial judge, of course, heard the evidence, was able to evaluate the witnesses. And there are a few places in the transcript, key moments that are marked incomprehensible. And the trial judge presumably heard whatever was said there and did not find it.
But you would agree, Nina, that Dickinson's burden is to show a reasonable probability that the jury would have decided the case differently if they'd been properly instructed.
Yes, but a reasonable probability is not the standard that the government is suggesting that means it was outcome determinative or certainly suggesting maybe a more likely than not standard. Reasonable probability, we're talking about just one juror could have looked at the evidence and thought, I think he might have intended to commit serious physical injury, but not to kill Mr. Hatch. And the evidence here is at least ambiguous and certainly susceptible to that inference.
Can you address the difference between the two standards of review? In other words, there seems to be an argument that the prejudice here is that he was precluded from making a stronger argument on appeal had the objection been properly preserved.
Yes, there are two independent arguments, Your Honor, either of which is sufficient to require relief. And so that's one of them. And under Arizona law, an instruction that lessens the state's burden to prove an element requires reversal. You don't have to look at the evidence. It requires reversal. And so had trial counsel preserved this issue, which the state doesn't dispute, the instruction lessened the burden, there would have been reversal. Certainly a reasonable probability that there would have been a different outcome on appeal.
Okay, what cases support your position that we have to look at the appellate standard versus the impact on of what happened at trial?
Well, Your Honor, there are cases out of published decisions out of three other circuits and an unpublished decision in this circuit where the appellate court held exactly that, the trial counsel's failure to preserve a viable issue deprived the defendant
Weren't those cases a little different in that they addressed the counsel's failure to preserve an argument for appeal or to preserve the right to appeal by, in one instance, failing to even file a notice of appeal versus the impact of a claim in the trial court?
Well, they do assess, and I see I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I might answer.
Please.
They do assess that. They do assess the impact of trial counsel's deficient performance on the appeal. And you're right that the Supreme Court cases seem to address the loss of an appeal entirely. But the circuit cases we've cited, which are Vanderpool, Parker, Rogers, and Burge, in all of those cases, the defendant was able to appeal the issue, but the standard on appeal for raising an unpreserved error was so high that he was not able to prevail. But the Federal Court of Appeals held that he would have prevailed, or there's a reasonable probability he would have prevailed on direct appeal if the issue had been preserved. I'm over time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Francis.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jillian Francis, Assistant Attorney General representing respondents in this matter. The district court correctly found that petitioner's claim was procedurally defaulted without excuse. Martinez does not act to excuse the procedural default because Dickinson has to show that PCR counsel is ineffective under Strickland, which requires a showing of both deficient performance and prejudice. And had the claim been raised in PCR proceedings, the PCR court would consider the state's repeated argument in opening and closing that the defendant intended to kill the victim, which I disagree with counsel, I believe is very important in assessing prejudice. And also the defendant's defense of mistaken identity, which if the jury would have believed the defendant, they would have been able to find him not guilty. We also have the evidence in this case, which includes the petitioner's own statement that he was going to kill the victim minutes before this incident took place. And the PCR court would have had before it the Court of Appeals opinion, which addressed prejudice under a less onerous burden. And I believe Your Honor asked about the difference in standard between fundamental error prejudice and prejudice under Strickland. And prejudice under fundamental error is a less onerous burden. In assessing prejudice under fundamental error review, the defendant would have to show a reasonable probability existed that the result of the proceeding could have been different, which is different than, of course, Strickland's prejudice prong, which requires that the result of the proceeding would have been different. And of course, under Strickland, it's not enough for the defendant just to show that the errors could have had some conceivable effect on the outcome of the proceedings. So
counsel, I want to make sure I understand here. So if this had been, if PCR counsel had raised this, then, and it had been reviewed for fundamental error, all you'd have to prove is that the result could have been different. Say that correctly?
I'm sorry, if PCR counsel had raised this, then the PCR court would be looking at Strickland prejudice. And so they would assess whether trial counsel was deficient and whether that deficiency prejudiced the defendant.
Okay, and whether the result would have been different or could have been different.
Whether the result would have been different.
Okay, so that's Strickland. But if counsel on direct appeal had argued that it was fundamental error, then all you would have to argue is that it could have been different.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. And which of these do we apply?
We apply Strickland prejudice here. The petitioner has the burden of showing that the result would have been different.
Okay. Now, Mr. Dickinson has argued that he's got sort of two avenues to do that. One is to sort of go through the error at the appeal, and the other is to sort of go through the error committed at the trial. So if we take that first one and go through the error in the appeal, isn't it apparent, even if we have to do Strickland and apply that to what would have happened at the appeal, that there clearly is error and that the Court of Appeals would have reversed this on appeal?
I'm not sure that they would have reversed it had the objection been raised, but in the PCR court would have had to apply Arizona law, which requires that the court look to whether the outcome of trial would have been different, not whether the defendant would have been entitled to a less onerous standard of review on appeal.
I mean, the error here is really quite serious. I mean, this is a slam dunk in our court if it comes up on direct appeal. If this had been made by one of our courts, you know, there's no question, I think, as to what we would have done in a case like this.
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends on the facts of each case. And the Court of Appeals did find that this error was error and it was fundamental. But when you look at the facts of this case and, like I said, the state's theory, the state in its opening statement, I believe it was the first couple sentences in, said the defendant intended to kill this victim.
Sure. And if we were here on a question as to whether there's, you know, giving all of the deference to the government as to whether there's sufficient evidence to sustain the verdict, I think that's an easy decision and that's an easy affirm for Arizona, if that's what we're asking. But that seems to me that if we were looking at this on direct appeal, that is the wrong question. You've got a bad error, and you have the possibility that you've got a juror who says, I've got some questions as to whether he really intended to kill him, but that's all. But I don't have to find that. All I have to find is that he intended to injure him. And that's pretty apparent. I mean, I think that's an easy one. If that's all you have to find for second degree murder in Arizona, this is a really easy verdict under almost any explanation here. But if you have to find that he intended to kill him when he ran him over with the truck, I think that's a closer question.
Right. Well, sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, right. Well, that, you know, if the claim had been raised then under direct appeal, the court would have addressed for harmlessness. But here the court addressed for prejudice, the Court of Appeals, I'm sorry. And I think if you look at the state's theory, the defendant's defense, all the evidence in this case, and I know Dickinson's counsel mentioned the judge's comments at the Rule 20 proceeding, and the judge there commented that the attempted second-degree murder would be the hardest to prove, because trying to convince a jury that he was intending to kill someone as opposed to mess him up is a harder thing to do. But he understood that intent to kill was required. And he allowed that to go forward to the jury. And I think all the parties, the prosecutor and the defense, all were under the impression that the intent to kill was required in that.
Except that's not entirely true, because the state's counsel repeated the wrong standard in his closing argument. He may have argued that they had shown enough to show intent to kill. But he reminds the jury of the wrong standard.
Right. That did happen. And I believe he was saying that he was just repeating the instruction, which contained that serious physical injury language. But he continually argued that the defendant in this case intended to kill the victim.
Counsel, I guess what bothers me about the petitioner's argument is if there's a difference between the standards of review here, we would conclude at the trial level, applying Strickland, that while there may have been error, it's insufficient for relief because there was substantial evidence of intent to kill the victim, and Dickinson cannot show a reasonable probability that the jury would have decided differently if properly instructed. But then we would say there was prejudice on direct appeal, which is sufficient for relief because it would have been difficult for the state to show that the instructional error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So you have an internal inconsistency there, and I can't resolve that inconsistency.
You understand my question?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But I think Judge Tallman, the Dickinson's counsel raised the instructional error on direct appeal. Raised on direct appeal.
Right.
I think that's where some of the confusion is coming from. He didn't object to the instruction at trial. Then counsel raised it on direct appeal, and the Arizona Court of Appeals applied their fundamental error standard because it hadn't been preserved, similar to our plain error standard. And so found that it was an error that is fundamental, then looked at prejudice and found that there wasn't prejudice. Then PCR, Post-Conviction Relief Counsel, filed a petition but didn't raise instructional error again. And then he filed his habeas petition and is arguing that his procedural default should be excused because of ineffective assistance from PCR counsel. And that claim would be based on ineffective assistance of trial counsel. So it gets pretty muddled going through all those procedures. I mean, I've heard a lot of the conversation back and forth saying what would have happened on appeal. Well, we know it was a direct appeal, and his counsel raised the instructional error argument.
Sorry, Your Honor.
You did a much better job of restating my concern.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just missed the last part of your question about the direct appeal, if you could repeat that. Or if that was a question.
Well, I wasn't asking a question. I was trying to figure out, you know, clarify what had happened below. And Judge Tallman had a question. I'm sorry, I jumped in.
No. All I said was I think you did a much better job of rephrasing my concern.
And I think I introduced some of the confusion. I think you clarified some of the confusion that I introduced. So,
okay.
Thank you.
All right. So, I'm sorry, Ms. Francis. We've kept you over. You want to just take a couple seconds to wrap up?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. I would just ask that this court first determine whether petitioner had shown cause to excuse the procedural default of PCR counsel for failing to raise the claim, and also ask that this court deny the writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Carlin, you had wanted to save a little time for rebuttal, and we took you right up, in fact, over your time. So if you want to take a minute or so for rebuttal, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to try to address first this could v. Wood versus Wood distinction. I think that's a red herring. The standard is a reasonable probability, and I think it's just...
Address my question, Ms. Carlin, as rephrased much better by Judge Beatty. You understand the concern here? We would be applying two different analyses, one at the trial level, one at the appellate level, using different standards of review. And therein lies an inconsistency that I just can't resolve.
I think I understand your question. And if you're talking about the standards of review that we apply for, I'm not sure if your question goes to the two separate arguments.
The claim was raised on direct appeal, but as Judge Beatty notes, Arizona law is such that if the trial counsel fails to object to the instruction, then the best you get is fundamental error review, which, as I understand it, is somewhat akin to our plain error standard under Federal Rule 52. Whereas, if it had been properly preserved, as Judge Bybee points out, and raised on direct appeal, he might have obtained relief because the state would have a higher burden of showing that that the conviction should be sustained beyond a reasonable doubt, even though there was error. And your argument, if we accept it, is that even though in the absence of an objection, there may have been no fundamental error at the trial level, but nonetheless, on habeas review, we're going to reverse and remand and find prejudicial error applying Strickland.
I think I understand your point, Your Honor. And again, that's one of two avenues. But again, three other courts of appeal and published decisions have accepted that, as has the Ninth Circuit in an unpublished disposition. And I'll note that three of those decisions, two of the published decisions and this court's decision, also were applying 2254D, which doesn't apply here. So they thought that that analysis was not only appropriate, but was compelled under Supreme Court precedent, under Strickland. I will ask the court to grant the writ.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon, and we will take this court under submission. And I believe that is our last. Okay. Oh, no, one more on the calendar. Wills versus Saul, which is case number 19-16053, and that was taken under submission on the briefs. And that is our calendar for today, so we will be in recess until tomorrow. Thank you.